Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Terrific to have you with us. My thanks again to Libby Dankman for sitting in the past couple of days on the program while I was getting myself well. Joining us now, the author of Why Cities Lose, The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide, which takes a look at for how long Americans have sorted themselves politically in larger cities, now, of course, along the coasts versus rural areas. The author of the book from Stanford University, where he's professor of political science and senior fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution, Jonathan A. Rodden. Professor Rodden, good to have you with us today.
Well, good to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Your book, Why Cities Lose, The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide, first takes us back to tell us for how long this has been going on, that really, you know, this dates back even pre-railroad, but that we've sorted ourselves along the old railroad line.
Right. We've started noticing this a lot more recently, but as we look back, this is this kind of correlation between population density and democratic voting is something that has been around for a long time. And I trace it to, it really kind of emerged in the 1920s and then especially in the New Deal period. But it has this roots in the labor movement and the concentration of manufacturing and workers in cities. And then when those groups made alliances with labor unions and eventually with the Democrats, that's when this started. And we can really see the legacy of that still hanging around in today's voting behavior.
Is it odd to you, though, that as cities have turned over and largely given up their manufacturing bases, and that you've got now knowledge workers and public employees dominating, that you've got a whole different demographic that is majority in many cities today, but the politics remains the same?
Right. That's part of what's so interesting about it is we certainly can't connect necessarily today's concentration of Democrats in cities so clearly to the Industrial Revolution, especially if we look at some places like cities like Santa Barbara, where they're overwhelmingly Democratic, but there were no factories and there were no mobilized labor unions in the early part of the century. So some things have really changed. You know, once the Democrats got that urban base, they sort of started to take up urban issues. They started to kind of form alliances with other groups of urban voters over time as new political issues have come to the fore. So once abortion became an issue in the 80s, people in urban areas tend to have more liberal views on that issue and other social issues related to religion and moral values, gay marriage and other related issues. And then when the gun issue comes along, immigration, race, all these issues, people in urban areas have preferences that are somewhat to the left of people in suburbs and rural areas. And once those issues become activated, the Democrats end up kind of starting with their initial base, they start to then take up the urban position on those other issues, and the party becomes increasingly urban over time.
I think the view of many leading Democrats has been demographics are on our side, and as a more diverse America, a better educated America, comes of voting age and becomes ever more invested in voting and political life, that is going to swamp the GOP essentially. And that this will become more than just a heavily urban concentrated phenomenon. But do you think that's not necessarily going to happen in the near term?
Well, the problem they've faced, and the one that I take a lot of I really pay attention to in the book, is that it's one thing to try to win majorities, and it's another thing to have those majorities be in the right places, given our system of government and the way we form our legislature through winner-take-all districts in the smaller districts in the House and statewide districts in the Senate. It matters a lot, not just whether you have a majority, and the Democrats typically win majorities if we just sort of add up all the votes in Senate elections, and they've won majorities in most of the most recent presidential elections. But having majorities in the right places in order to win legislative victories is another matter, and that's something that they've struggled with, given the geography that I've been pointing out, given their concentration in cities.
We understand how that plays out in the Senate. How has this played out in state legislatures of states that have Democratic majorities but have Republican-controlled legislatures? How does that happen?
Well, this is something that people have been paying a lot of attention to recently, of course, the first place we look is to gerrymandering, and that is quite a big part of the story in a number of states. But if we look a little bit closer, it turns out that gerrymandering is just part of the story, and there's maybe even a precursor to that story, which is that Democrats have been so concentrated in cities that they've found it hard to win outside of cities. And so they've been able to win. Sometimes it's possible to win a majority, say, in a Senate race or a gubernatorial election in a state like Pennsylvania. But really by mobilizing a lot of votes in cities. But that doesn't really help you win the kind of pivotal district in the state legislature, which is often a kind of suburban or exurban district or maybe a mixed district. And so in a place like Pennsylvania, the Democrats have gone for decades without winning the state Senate. And that has happened both when the Democrats and when the Republicans have drawn the districts.
We're talking with Stanford University professor of political science, Jonathan A. Rodden. He's also a senior fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution, and he founded and directs the Stanford Spatial Social Science Lab as well. He's author of Why Cities Lose, The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide. You can ask questions of him on our AirTalk page, kpcc.org, or you can join us at 866-893-5722, 866-893-KPECC. Do you think, as you look ahead to the 2020 presidential election, that President Trump, despite the fact that he's got historically, you know, low approval ratings, could find himself reelected because of the kind of geographic politics you're talking about?
Well, that's a good question. And this is something that both parties are really trying to think about. Where are they going to get the votes they need to win the pivotal states? So when we're talking about the presidency, when we're talking about the Electoral College, it really matters who wins those pivotal states kind of in the middle, the ones that are contested. And so it has come to be the case in recent years that these end up being battles over turnout between urban voters and kind of exurban and rural voters. And turnout has just been not just in the last election, but for a long time now, much higher. And this is kind of an interesting thing about the U.S. in contrast to other countries. Our turnout tends to be much higher in rural areas, and it's dreadfully low in urban areas. Sometimes in the urban core of a big U.S. city, it'll be below 50%. And in the suburbs, it might be north of 75%. So that's a big difference. And the parties have a lot of incentive to try to affect turnout in those places. And so I think we will see a battle over turnout between especially urban and rural areas, but a big part of the battle will be in suburbs.
What do you think Democrats can take from the success with the House in 2018? I mean, beyond having an unpopular president, are there particular approaches they took in those suburban and exurban districts that you think are a template for the future?
Right. In some ways, they're taken from the past. The Democratic Party has always been an incredibly diverse party, and there's always been a big difference between the kind of urban base, the urban core, and the folks who are out there trying to win suburban and rural districts. And that hasn't changed. And I think what we've seen in the past was that the Democrats were able to nominate and run a very different type of candidate in suburban and rural districts than they did in urban districts. And they were able to get away with that. That's become harder over time, and especially with all the media attention to the Squad and all of the debates about that. But it does seem to be the case that the Democrats still have the ability to nominate candidates in places like Kentucky or in rural Oklahoma, suburban Oklahoma City or suburban Salt Lake City, that are able to eke out majorities.
Well, we saw that, of course, Orange County here in Southern California. And I guess, it is funny because you mentioned the members of the Squad who, get all the attention from media and from President Trump. But I think there are more representatives like those from Southern California who are first termers who have to represent split districts and have to be more moderate than there are new members of the Squad type politics.
That's right. And that's kind of an old problem for parties of the left and democracies that use winner-take-all districts. It's something labor parties have always kind of struggled with, that you have this urban core that tends to be very progressive, and they're really just reflecting the views of their constituents. But those views are really pretty far away from, say, the views of the median voter in Orange County. And so a Democratic representative of a place like that has to cringe when all the media attention is given to the urban representatives. Or, you know, in Britain, if you're a moderate Labour Party member and, you know, all the attention obviously is given to Jeremy Corbyn, this is also a problem for you if you're running in a kind of a suburban pivotal district. So that's kind of the problem they face. And the media attention given to the kind of the loudest voices and the most interesting voices can be a problem for them.
We're talking about the underrepresentation politically of cities based on their population size and the challenge for Democrats, though they get larger raw numbers of votes typically, where those votes come from and the tight concentration of that voting leaves Democrats with a real challenge. We'll continue our conversation with Stanford University Professor of Political Science Jonathan A. Rodden in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about the deep roots of the urban-rural political divide in America. Jonathan A. Rodden is author of Why Cities Lose. He's at Stanford, where he's political science professor and also a senior fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. If you have questions for him about the premise of his book, as well as some of the recommendations he makes to Democrats attempting to increase their political power, we're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Specifically, to increase Democratic political power, how much of a difference would it make to move to, you know, what some European countries use, proportional representation instead of the winner-take-all American model?
Right. This is something that lots of European countries did early in the century when those urban labor-oriented parties first started to enter the scene. They really started to squeeze out some of the existing parties, and because they were fearful of that, they got together and voted kind of strange coalitions of parties. Got together and voted for reform that created a more proportional electoral system. And there are some countries, the U.S. and Britain and Canada, Australia and New Zealand initially, that avoided that reform and stayed with single-member districts. So the question is, what would happen in a country like the United States if it made that kind of reform today? And I think there are a couple of things that might emerge. I mean, one of the things that happens when a democracy moves to proportional representation as we end up with more political parties and more competition, entry of parties like Greens and perhaps libertarians or liberal parties. And it really changes the way that different issues are bundled together by the parties and can have the impact of reducing the kind of polarization, this kind of bimodal mindset that we've gotten into. So one of the nice things about proportional representation is that it can just reduce polarization. And it also creates a situation in which parties are represented according to their vote share, and geography becomes quite a bit less important in a system like that.
When you look at European countries that have that sort of proportional representation, is there even more antipathy, though, from ex-urban and rural residents because they feel like they get run roughshod over by where all the people live?
Well, I haven't noticed that emerging as a real issue. It just the whole kind of urban-rural frame to politics seems less present in proportional representation countries. And it turns out that it's not the case necessarily that urban parties are necessarily left parties. So it turns out lots of urban people, especially in the kind of wealthy knowledge economy city centers, tend to be right of center on economic issues, but left of center on social issues. And so in a place like Sweden, there are parties that push together those issues. We have liberal parties and others who are pro-gay marriage and pro-abortion rights, but anti-tax, for instance. And those parties actually, when they are able to form governments, they form coalitions with parties of the right that are stronger in rural areas. So it doesn't really turn into this battle between cities and rural areas. It's our system really pushes us into that battle. And we see it in Britain, and we now see it in a very strong way in Canada also.
Joaquin has a terrific point to raise on the AirTalk page. Says, in this similar to at-large council members, weren't cities sued and forced to have distinct geographic districts on civil rights grounds? And of course they were, is absolutely right. Because what happened is that the dominant population was able to elect all of those at-large council district seats. And so you would have racial and ethnic minority groups would end up shut out of the process. They tended to concentrate in specific districts, but wouldn't have anyone who lived in that district end up actually being elected to an at-large seat. I suppose you could argue that for exurban and rural Americans, they would be in the place there of the minority group in the United States, and they would be concerned about losing their seat at the table in, you know, one of these other political reform measures, Professor.
Yeah, I think if we had a proportional electoral system, that one of the nice things about it is I don't think anyone really has to worry about losing a seat at the table. They would if their party was one of the smaller parties, they would have the opportunity to form a coalition with another party. I think in the context of school board elections or municipal elections in California under the California Voting Rights Act, where partisanship is much less an issue, and in some of these races, some of these elections, race and ethnicity really become important considerations. I think that's really a pretty different scenario, but it is an interesting comparison, and I think there's a lot that we still want to learn about the big transition that's been taking place in California from at large to winner-take-all districts. And one of the things that happens once a community gets that demand letter and they start to introduce electoral districts, elections become very non-competitive. We end up drawing a bunch of districts around the existing incumbents, and the elections end up not even being held because no one challenges the incumbents. So there is something nice about having competitive elections, and at-large elections do introduce more turnout and better competition. But and there are ways of structuring those that are not harmful to minorities. For instance, if we use ranked choice voting.
Now, in many American cities, there are efforts to make them denser and to make public transit people's preferred mode of getting around, the big issue in California with the housing crisis that exists. But despite that, is it true that we are becoming more suburbanized? And then what are the implications for politics through that?
Right. This is one of the things that if we're living in one of these coastal cities, it seems to us that there's this big renaissance of cities. And we see lots of people moving back into cities like San Francisco, and we see increasing rents. But in fact, in much of the country, the opposite thing is happening, and people are suburbanizing at a pretty impressive rate. But what that means is that Democrats and Republicans are actually becoming, in places like suburban Houston, more intermixed, and we're becoming a little less segregated by partisanship in those places where the exurbs are really growing quickly.
And so the parties are going to have to do, as we saw in the Orange County congressional race, try and court across party lines. Thank you so much, Professor Rodden. Good to talk with you about your new book.
Thanks for having me.
Why Cities Lose, The Deep Roots of the Urban-Rural Political Divide, Stanford University Professor of Political Science, Jonathan A. Rodden, the author, is also senior fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. Have a terrific afternoon. Fresh Air comes up next here on 89.3. Back with you tomorrow morning at 10.